We have to make changes in our behaviors and we have to do things differently. It's you can't just keep doing the same thing over and over again and expect a different outcome. But when you start to listen to what's happening within your own self, there's guidance there.
Welcome to Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff, where we interview newsmakers, storytellers, and all-around interesting people. Sit back, relax, unless you're driving, and enjoy the show. Here's Jackson.
Hello, hello, hello. I am Jackson Huff. This is Not in a Huff. Thanks so much for joining me. As always, really appreciate it. This week's speak with Danielle Reif. Now, this is a really, really powerful conversation. It's one that I think that we get, I guess, a little bit more into, I don't know, maybe my opinions more than I ever do. But I think this is just, it's hard not to give your opinion when some of this is just common sense to me. But we're going to talk to Danielle about her career, her 20 plus year career as someone that works for USAID. I had a terrible time trying to say, I wanted to say USAID. I wanted to say all kinds of stuff, but it's USAID, which is the government organization in the United States that basically helps other countries monetarily. So, you know, she talks about going into Africa and helping peace processes there. She talks about all going all over the world and basically just helping monetarily our friends, being good citizens of the world, and in turn, you know, obviously currying some favor with countries that that we help. This is, I guess, kind of a program that's been a common sense for a long time, that we want to be good neighbors in the world as the United States. We want to also help others just ethically. That's been under attack lately. And as we're speaking, USAID is something that is being drastically cut. So I thought it was important to have her on just to talk about, what did she do for the last 20 years in USAID? Why is it important, and why should we worry about it being cut? I will completely let you decide whether, after hearing from Danielle, if you're like, yep, glad it's being cut down, or you're thinking, hey, maybe this is more important than people think. And my personal opinion, it does seem to be, after hearing from her, even more important that we don't cut things like this. But, that's neither here nor there. For those who are listening that's not even from the United States, you know, there's a lot of countries that are impacted by this. I know there's several African countries, several smaller Asian countries that rely a lot on foreign aid. And this is a pretty dire thing to just no longer have it. One minute you have it, the next minute you don't. So I really, really appreciate Danielle coming on. She does the absolute best she can just to kind of just talk the facts and give very little opinion. But we talk about her career. We talk about her new, basically, consulting firm that talks about peace building and making sure that we all are kind of on the same common ground. That's a common theme in this podcast, that, hey, no matter how different we feel like we are, there's always something that connects us. And that's something that we should really hang our hats on at the moment when, you know, things are a little bit more divided, that, hey, we can find common ground. And I do hope, you know, for everyone's sake, that's something that we strive to do. And I think it starts with all of us. So, you know, she's going to talk about that too. It doesn't take something from the top. It takes just things from every one of us to say, hey, we don't want violence. We don't want to fight. We want to find common ground. So I think that's a really powerful message from her. But enough from me. Here is Danielle Reif. Ms. Reif, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm going to kind of let you do the heavy lifting right out the gate. Just introduce yourself.
My name is Danielle Reif. I am a professional peace builder and a retired USAID Foreign Service officer. I'm also a writer and an editor.
No, I love it. We're gonna unpack a good chunk of that, and I want to kind of start. We were talking about it briefly before we started recording, but you said something that is very much in the news right now. You at one point worked for USAID, which stands for the U.S. Agency for International Development. I'll let you dive into why it's in the news if you'd like. But I want you, before we get to that, just talk a little bit about the work that you did with USAID. And then we're going to kind of break down why that work may be important.
Thank you. So it's USAID. It's not USAID. It's USAID.
Oh, I'm saying it wrong. All right.
Okay. And there was a moment several years ago where the agency was undergoing some branding renovations, and there was debate in the agency about how do you pronounce the acronym? Is it USAID or is it USAID? Or we had a whole debate about that.
Gotcha.
But I think we settled on USAID. And I worked there for a full 20 years. I had a full career as a Foreign Service officer. It was one of those things when I was finishing up grad school, I wasn't quite sure where I wanted to work, but I had a few friends who were so excited. They'd been trying to prepare themselves for the Foreign Service for many years. Their dream was to join the Foreign Service, and they were applying. He said, go ahead and do it, Danielle. So I also applied. I got in, and they didn't right away. They eventually got in a few years later. But I did spend 20 years living and working around the world. And what we do for the most part at USAID is we design and manage development assistance. So projects aim to promote stability and peace and all the good things in developing countries around the world. So while I was with USAID, I served in, let's see if I can name them. I served in Colombia, Uganda, South Sudan, the Republic of Georgia in the former Soviet Union, and Sri Lanka.
Yeah, it's a lot of different places for sure. A lot of different, I'm sure, totally different reasons to need that type of work. So I think that's really awesome. I think it's kind of interesting too that I've talked to a lot of people that work for different agencies in the federal government, whether it's FBI or DEA or a lot of different agencies. It almost always starts with, you know, I like the DEA guy. I always wanted to work for the CIA, and I had all these friends that wanted to work for the DEA. I got into the DEA. I didn't even necessarily want to be there. And all these other friends didn't. Same thing with the FBI. I feel like maybe they just know what you want and they make sure you don't get it right out the gate.
So I guess my story's not unique is what you're telling me.
It's not. It's kind of sad it's that way. But hey, I don't know. They've got a method that potentially works.
Well, I was thrilled when I got accepted. It's an exciting prospect when you're at the beginning of, you know, for the next 20 years or however long you work with the agency, you'll be moving every few years to a new country, learning a new culture, learning new languages, working on programs that are designed to both help the development of the countries where we're based, but also serve the U.S. national interests. That's sort of the intersection where USAID sits. And so, yeah, it's exciting. And it turned out to be the most extraordinary experience, certainly, I could ever have had. I feel like I learned far more living in different countries for 20 years than I ever could have just reading books about it or even just on vacation. I think living and working in a place is really one of the best ways to learn about it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Being immersed in those cultures, I'm sure is way different than a textbook. That's for sure. I mean, a very open-ended question. You can answer it the way you want, but this whole USAID is in the news at the moment. Well, why is that? Why is that the case?
I think it's complicated, and there are certainly political dynamics involved, which we don't necessarily need to go into, but you know, USAID was created by John F. Kennedy, who had the idea that we needed to be citizens, not just in our own country, but citizens of the world. We needed to be serving the world and bringing our gifts and our talents and our knowledge and advantages to other places. He, of course, also created the Peace Corps, and I served in the Peace Corps. But the tradition of helping other countries to recover from war and poverty, it goes all the way back to the Marshall Plan at the end of World War II. Of course, there was a lot of destruction in Europe and elsewhere after the war. And the countries in Europe were struggling economically and just couldn't do it on their own. They needed help. And so the U.S. and a few other allies got together and they created the Marshall Plan, which was basically a plan to fund the reconstruction and redevelopment of Europe after the war. And it led to, you know, the eventual prosperity and recovery of a whole continent. And so that's really the tradition we're talking about. But along the way, what we learned, of course, there's a lot of research about development and peace building and how it works and what it means. And along the way, maybe in the 90s, there was a big spurt of study and research that basically said, you know, and it outlined that cleaning up a place after a war is actually a lot more expensive than preventing the war in the first place. And so USAID, the role that we play, you know, a lot of people don't see the connection between that and our national security. But when USAID is in a country supporting democratic institutions, supporting the health and education of a population, helping small businesses to grow and flourish, we're basically helping to create conditions in those countries where the people who are there feel fulfilled, they want to stay there, they're thriving there. And so it ultimately, it prevents violence to agree, it prevents mass migration. It really is building the capacity of these countries to take care of themselves so that the U.S. and other international players don't have to. And, you know, it's a minor investment for the massive returns that we get, to be honest. So why is it in the news now? I mean, the long and the short of it, without getting into partisan politics, is that I think the current government doesn't have that belief that John F. Kennedy did in the 1960s, that we should be citizens, not just of our own country, but of the world, and that we should play a positive role in helping helping other countries. And so we're pulling back from that. I think the whole Make America Great Again is about investing in the U.S. Rather than in other places. And, you know, we're a small agency and relatively unknown. I suspect they believe that, you know, they could do what they're doing at USAID and nobody would notice and nobody would care. But in my opinion, it's interesting that, you know, for my entire 20 years with USAID, I would say the name USAID. I would talk about what I did. I loved what I did. I would get excited about my stories. And people just sort of, their eyes glossed over and they just didn't know and they didn't really care so much. So there was a limit to what people wanted to know. And now that we're in the current situation, all of a sudden in Congress and in the news and in people's kitchen tables, they're actually talking in great detail about what USAID does and asking all the questions and, you know, wanting to know more deeply, you know, is this having an impact? Is it not having an impact? So ultimately, this has raised awareness of USAID in a way that, you know, is unprecedented, really. And so I think that's got some potential in the future. I mean, I think it's a good thing that people are asking questions and want to understand better than they ever have before.
Yeah, no, for sure. And yeah, and I don't like to dive into anything too partisan unless there's a way that I could see on both ends and not when it comes to defunding. And I'm talking about both ends of why it may be important. It seems like, you know, what you talked about mostly was about it's important because just being a good citizen of the world is important. Just, you know, morally, that's an important thing. Then that's already enough. But let's say we don't care about that. Let's say we're just callous and that we could care less about that part of it. It's important for the other side of things because, I mean, it's just common sense that if we're giving money to these other countries and they are kind of relying on that, they're probably going to kind of listen to what we want them to do. So it's important on that side of things too.
Oh, it's an incredible asset for the U.S. to build relationships, trusted relationships, alliances, friendships. And you're right. And this is sort of the essence of development assistance and peace building, is that when you have good, trusted relationships with other people, with other countries, when you need each other, you help each other and support each other, and you try to make each other better. And so, yeah, that's, but don't forget, there's also the national security aspect. So when you prevent migration, when you prevent violent extremism, when you prevent extreme poverty and the conditions that foment political violence, you're ultimately benefiting the U.S. and Americans. So yeah, so there are lots of reasons to do it, lots of reasons. And when we pull back, so what's happening now, unfortunately, it was done so suddenly and unexpectedly that it's pulled the rug out from under not only the thousands of people who worked for USAID and with USAID in the U.S., so thousands of Americans suddenly losing jobs and being put in really difficult financial situation. But in addition to that, we've pulled the rug out from underneath our friends and allies in other countries, organizations that were counting on their grants, that had all sorts of plans, you know, and were learning new things. And all of a sudden, all those people as well are without jobs and the projects have come to a complete halt. You know, there are lots of statistics about the humanitarian assistance that very suddenly was halted and was rotting in the ports while people were dying of hunger. So, you know, people who desperately needed some of the HIV medicines that we facilitate suddenly not having access to their medicine. And it happened so quickly that people didn't have time to develop other alternatives. I think in a more typical political environment, you know, it's let me be clear, it's not illegitimate to want to reduce USAID foreign assistance and to invest more money in the U.S. instead. That's absolutely a viable and important policy conversation for us to have as a country. And maybe we are in such trouble in the U.S. that we need to rebalance, you know, our international and domestic engagement. So that's, you know, that's an important policy conversation to have. Usually under typical circumstances, you have a conversation, you have a national conversation about it, and you raise people's awareness, you have meaningful debates and discussions. And if at the end of the day, the decision is to reduce USAID, you do it in a responsible way that strives not to do harm. And I think that's in international development circles, like development 101, one of the first things that we try to make sure is that with our assistance, we're doing no harm to other people. And I think the way this was done was not done following the do no harm principle. And it's just caused a lot of heartache and a lot of difficult fallout, unfortunately.
Yeah. So, I mean, the next question was, you know, obviously this has turned into a little bit of a partisan issue, but has that been the case in the past? Was this department always a partisan issue? I mean, obviously we look at like Department of Education, you know, one side has always wanted to end that as soon as it started, but has this ever been the like this before, or was it just created as a partisan issue until recently?
That's a fantastic question, and the answer is not a clean one. You know, so there have been particularly Republicans in past decades who really thought USAID should be smaller. And there were some efforts out of Congress, for example, in the 90s, there was a huge hiring freeze for a whole decade because Congress didn't want us to be hiring more people. They, you know, preferred that USAID have a smaller staffing footprint. So there have been some partisan efforts along the way, and certainly some of the debate falls along party lines. But also, during the 20 years that I worked for USAID, we have overwhelmingly had a bipartisan support out of Congress, both parties. And even, you know, Marco Rubio and other people who are in charge now, if you look back at their statements over the years, you'll find statements where they say USAID is really critical for our national security and it's an important investment that we make. And you don't think USAID budget is, I mean, you hear these big numbers, you know, millions and billions of dollars, but the reality is USAID's budget is less than 1% of the national budget. So really very minuscule in the grand scheme of things. And when you talk about waste, fraud, and abuse, so in terms of percentages, every agency has like a minor percentage of waste, fraud, and abuse. It's just sort of a part of reality. But the DOD's budget is so big that the percentage of their budget that ends up, you know, in the bucket of waste, fraud, and abuse is actually bigger than the entire USAID budget. You know, so in terms of eliminating waste, fraud, and abuse, it's not even necessarily the most, you know, efficient way to do it. You know, canceling USAID is not the most efficient way to save money in the federal budget.
Yeah. The last question I want to ask you about that particular world, and then we're going to move into what you're doing now. You know, because I think the easy way to kind of turn people against that particular aspect of things is kind of come up with all these wild things that it may be covering. You know, we always talked about the waste, fraud, and abuse. I think that there's been things out there that, you know, it was covering all kinds of crazy stuff. My question to you is, talk about some of the things, you know, you already talked about some of the places you've been because of the department and your work there. Talk about some of the, I guess, impactful things that you're able to work on.
Oh, that's a fun question to answer. But first, let me say, yes, there's a thing in logic called the straw man fallacy. And the straw man fallacy is basically when somebody cherry picks one small piece of something that they disagree with, or, you know, maybe doesn't sound rational in and of itself. And they elevate that small piece and they say, this doesn't make sense. And therefore, none of it makes sense. It's actually a logical fallacy. Just because, you know, so in a $5 million program, the idea that we're just doing one little thing in a $5 million program, it's not real. It's not real. In a $5 million program, you would have robust outcomes and outputs. And like a $5 million project is going to be doing a lot more than just one little thing. So there's the way it's being presented at all is also a bit of it's a fallacy. It's a logical fallacy. In terms of the fun stuff that I've worked on, one of the favorite things that I've done during my career is I worked in Uganda during a peace process between the government and the Lord's Resistance Army, which is a rebel group that was kidnapping people in the northern part of Uganda. And so all the a couple of million people in northern Uganda who were in displaced persons camps, so they were living in camps basically that were densely populated and without all the regular services they would have if they were living in their villages. And it was really hard for people to live in those circumstances, and there was violence. And anyway, so there was a peace process started shortly after I arrived in Uganda in 2005. And I had always dreamed of working on a peace process. And lo and behold, a few years into my assignment, there was a standstill in the peace process. They were negotiating over justice issues and, you know, who was going to be arrested, and truth and reconciliation issues. How do you repair relationships in the country and move on from the war? And neither party really, you know, was giving much in the negotiations. And so they decided to hold national consultations. The mediator said, okay, both sides, why don't you go out into the country and ask people, how do you think we should handle truth and reconciliation issues? How do you think we should handle justice for the rebels or the government or whoever has committed crimes? And so the government came to the U.S. Embassy and asked for our help. They said, you know, we've got just a month to do this. They haven't given us much time. And we could sure use some help. And so I had the honor of being the representative of USAID in the US Embassy to the planning process for those consultations. And I sat with the US, the government of Uganda peace team and several others, and we designed these consultations. And the peace team ended up going to 11 different locations around the country. And I'm really passionate about civic education and people getting involved in policy debates and in, governance issues to help determine the outcomes that affect their lives. And this consultation process was so inspiring. The energy around it was surreal. It really was. Across the country, people were organizing pre-consultation consultations, and the church groups and the civil society sector and local governments and communities, everybody was talking about this question: how do we repair our relationships in this country and move past the war? And that discussion was unlocked by these national consultations on the peace process. And I'll say that in the end, what people wanted was a truth-telling mechanism across the board. Sort of the one takeaway people said was, we really just want to understand what has actually happened here. In a war, you don't get full information, and it's difficult to really understand what's happening. So they just wanted a truth-telling mechanism where people could come forward and they could put together a story that everybody understood about what had really happened during the war. And then, there was so much energy around that. And after the peace process, there wasn't, there was still a conversation. But 20 years later, so just a few years ago, the government of Uganda, for the first time ever, established a policy, a government policy for transitional justice. And I think some of the energy for that came from 20 years ago when we did those national consultations and got the whole country talking about this. So that's one of the most fun things I worked on during my career.
Yeah, that's powerful and impactful. I'm sure to many people, every Ugandan. So I think that's really awesome for sure. And I want to transition now into, I mean, you made a little bit of a transition outside of USAID, but it's still in the world of peace building. So talk a little bit about kind of your current work.
Yeah, so important to know that I retired from USAID a few months ago, so I'm not affected by the current situation, but I'm trying to be of service to my former colleagues in whatever ways I can. But yeah, in my new retired incarnation, I guess, I am doing a lot of writing, and I'm also doing a lot of advocacy for peace. I'm really a peace activist in my heart and soul. So I do a lot of promotion of what it means to be a peace builder. And three core values sit at the heart of what it means to be a peace builder. There's love, a belief that all human beings have innate value above and beyond their belief systems or demographics. There's unity and diversity. I believe that, in a globalized world, we're living now in more diverse communities than we ever have before, and I don't think that's going to change. So rather than fight against diversity, I think the key challenge, and certainly a peace builder, is going to work to try to figure out how do we live together in harmony, because the diversity is not going to change. And then third is nonviolence. And if you look at all the great peace builders of the past, Martin Luther King and Gandhi and others, they all were clear that the means must be consistent with the ends. So if you want to create a peaceful society, we have to get a whole heck of a lot better at nonviolent conflict resolution. And we're growing in our ability to do that. There's ever more research and practice, and we are getting better at it. And I believe we'll continue to get better and better until we achieve greater states of peace in our communities and in our world. But anyway, so I'm pr promoting what it means to be a peace builder. And then I have a book coming out in a few months, which is about media literacy for peace building. Certainly in the digital age, one of the challenges we have that we had before, but it's now on steroids, is the spread of disinformation and propaganda and such. And so the book basically concludes that if we want to live in more peaceful societies, then we're all going to have to learn how to be more responsible and savvy readers of news and information. Like, before we could count on like really good quality media outlets to follow all the rules of journalism and make sure all the sources were verified and all that. But now there's so many more sources of information and news that, yeah, we're going to have to do that level of verification of information on our own as individuals. We can't avoid that anymore.
Yeah, no, I've heard that before. I talked to a White House correspondent that's worked through several different administrations, and same thing. There's just a lot more noise out there from everywhere, so it's a little bit harder to disseminate what is the accurate information anymore. So I understand that for sure. I always like to kind of point out when, you know, I'm asking questions that you kind of had laid out, because they seem like strange questions for me just to randomly come up with, but I know there are things that you can answer. One of them is just, obviously we talked about how a changing landscape. You just mentioned that yourself. So, you know, regardless of how you feel about anything, what side you stand on, it's obviously a turbulent, it's a challenging time, and it's one that, you know, there's a lot of tension and high energy. How do people cultivate inner peace in those times?
Yeah, it's hard, isn't it? It's so hard. And I think that people who are looking to the outside world to make sense for them, as, you know, if you're counting on other people to make sense of the world for you, you're going to struggle quite a bit. And if you're reading the news, you know, I think most people who are reading the news are pretty stressed out about it. And certainly within USAID and within the US government, the people who are being affected by some of this very sudden closure of USAID and government agencies, I'm talking to people who are experiencing literally like symptoms of trauma. So I don't want to make light of the fact that people are literally dissociated and traumatized by what's happening in our information environment and in our political environment. It's a very, very difficult thing. And yet, Jackson, I'm a deeply spiritual person. I believe that we all actually have the answers inside us, and that if we can focus on building up our own self-love, our own self-awareness, that we can find ways to take our own inner resources and strengthen our own capacity to love and our own capacity to find peace. And it begins within. It begins within. And so one of the important things people can do, if you're overwhelmed by everything that's happening in the outside world, is you can sort of remove yourself, at least temporarily, and just try to listen to your own self. What are you really feeling? What are you really thinking? You know, apart from what everybody else thinks and feels, like, what am I thinking? What do I really think about this? Sometimes, I mean, it seems so easy and so obvious, but we often get so overwhelmed by everything that's going on that we forget to check in with ourselves. Only once you understand your own patterns and what you think and what you're feeling and how everything's affecting you, can you start to make changes in your own life that actually increase your own sense of inner peace and create conditions for peace in your home and your community. But getting to inner peace and building peaceful communities is not easy at all, but, you know, we have to make changes in our behaviors and we have to do things differently. It's, you can't just keep doing the same thing over and over again and expect a different outcome. But when you start to listen to what's happening within your own self, there's guidance there. There's guidance there. And you can tap into it and start to make changes in your life that can increase in your life and in your community.
Yeah. And we're talking about, peace. There's different levels under that, whether, it's discontent or unease. But let's talk about complete opposite of peace, and that is literal violence, which is not, we're not all that far away from sometimes. So how do you, I guess, how do we make sure that we kind of try to end that threat of violence, and I guess more importantly, political violence?
Yeah, it's such an important question. And, especially when there are leaders that are fomenting these divisions and fomenting the violence, it's easy to look outside yourself and say, oh, all these people are creating violence. And until they stop, the violence isn't going to stop. And how can I stop them? How can I have an influence on these big people? And there are things people can do. There's advocacy and all sorts of things. I actually believe that the real change is a cultural thing, and in terms of acceptance of violence. So one thing that people can do is speak out against violence. If you see violence happening in your community, in your political party, in your country, and it makes you uncomfortable and you don't like it, you can speak out. You can post something on social media. You can share your thoughts with your family, with your community, that this isn't okay. Because at the end of the day, all the literature about social behavior and how people decide what they think and how they behave, a lot of it, is that people are taking cues from the people around them. And if they think everybody, accepts political violence, then they get nervous to speak out. And that's happened over the last several years in this country. Sort of moderate people, decent people who want decency, who want community, who want us to just get along, they've been so, sort of disheartened because the voices on the extremes are so loud that they've backed out and said, well, I want decency, but I'm a little afraid right now, so I'm not going to say anything. But in fact, it's speaking up that makes the difference, and that's what starts to create a culture. And if enough people speak out and say, we don't want the violence, it's not who we are as a country, it's not who I am, I'm not going to participate, and I refuse to accept it, I refuse to support it, I refuse to, engage in any way. Slowly but surely, you build pockets, where people can then band together. People who don't support political violence can band together, and then those pockets come together, and then so you have to build it slowly but surely over time. But there's research that says that in an environment where we have close relationships among each other, only 25% of people need to voice a new value in order for it to be broadly accepted. So only 25% of people in our communities, in our country, need to stand up and vehemently oppose political violence. And then it sort of like expands in the culture, and people take their cues from that, and they say, oh, wait a minute, maybe this isn't such a good idea. And then you have more and more people who are opposing it, and then they're voting based on those belief systems, and then they're speaking out against it, and it just expands. It's a cultural thing, and it can start in very small groups, start in very small ways, speaking out, and then you find other people who agree, and then the community of people who's trying to build something new and different, a peaceful society, that community just gets bigger and bigger and bigger until eventually it's not cool anymore. Political violence isn't cool anymore. And then once it's not cool anymore, people have less incentive to do it. And then
Yeah.
they get
Oh.
a lot more pushback when they do.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great start. And even if we were to just do that, I think it would be a huge thing. It'd make a huge impact. But outside of that, what people that want to, I guess, contribute more to peace in their community, what can they do?
Yeah, it's a great question. So the research says that when people are working together across divides on like towards shared objectives or on joint projects, that they let their guard down and they get to know each other and trust each other as fellow human beings and neighbors and community members. So I think one thing that people can do is to go out into your community. You can either do it as an individual, you can do it as a neighborhood, you can find an organization in your community. Just start to spend time with people who may not have the same beliefs as you do, and see if you can organize, you know, let's go together and pick up the trash in our neighborhood on Saturday morning. Just spend a couple hours together doing something together. So it's when we're actually working together towards common goals with people who we perceive as different that we realize they're not so different after all.
Yeah, no, that's been a common theme when I've talked to anybody that's, you know, done much of anything out there in the world. And that is, you know, we feel like we're different, but if we really look at things, we're all pretty much the same. And that's what I've learned. I've done almost 300 of these interviews, people that have done extremely different things than me, but you can always, always find those common ground. So I think that's something that
yes,
I think we lose sight of.
Find common ground with other people if you just look for it. But the problem is we get afraid of each other. We start to fear each other. And then even having a conversation becomes hard. And then people get nervous. And then, you know, the imagination runs wild. And you start imagining that those people are doing crazy things or, you know. So there is actual data that shows. So they've done surveys where they ask people how far apart on policy issues do Democrats and Republicans think they are. And then they ask them about their positions on the policies themselves. And consistently what's happening is that people believe there's huge gap between them and the other side, when in reality is their policy differences aren't necessarily that far apart. But in order to discover how far apart they are and to bridge the gap, you just have to talk to each other. And the more, you know, there's a lot of fear mongering and a lot of really hateful, like the straw man fallacy, where you hold up one thing and you say, these are bad. This one little thing. Look at this one little thing. Aren't those people bad people? They're bad people. And then once you start to believe they're bad people, then you don't want to talk to them. Or if you hear they're quote unquote criminals, then you're afraid. But the reality is, if we can just, you know, trust each other enough to start a conversation, like you said, we can always find some common ground. And then you build from there.
Yeah, for sure. And I guess kind of the last hard question I've got for you, and then we're just going to let you promote some of your book and things, is, you know, obviously we always think the current times is the best or the worst or the craziest or the most exciting. You know, everyone just looks at current events, and we can look at now and see, you know, we already talked about there's quite a bit of, you know, political tension and unease between a lot of different people and that kind of thing. Obviously, we've had times that, you know, we went through world wars and we went through civil war. So there's been definitely some other times of some pretty extreme tension. But when it comes to kind of in history, how do you think, you know, our time now compares? Is it truly kind of at the level that people maybe feel? I mean, I'm not trying to discount it. I'm wondering whether, you know, it's truly how people may be feeling, that, you know, that much discontent, or is it really kind of just a cyclical thing that we'll probably get through?
I believe these things are cyclical, and I am confident that we will not only get through, but that, you know, in the end, we'll be able to take the pieces and the ruins of whatever is destroyed now and build something even better than we've ever had before in the upswing of the cycle afterwards. I actually believe we're in twin processes of integration and disintegration, and the unrest we're feeling is because the systems that we've known and relied on seem to be crumbling in front of our very eyes. Our two-party political system doesn't seem to be, you know, we've been proud Americans and an example around the world of democracy for almost 250 years. And yet our democratic institutions are struggling to cope with the current moment. And that can be disconcerting. That brings a lot of dis-ease. Like, if we can't count on that, what can we count on? I believe we're also building at the same time. And the kinds of things we talked about, you know, people bridging our divides and working together in communities and growing a culture of peace, that's also happening. It's not in the news. It's not as quote unquote sexy, so it doesn't get as much coverage. But I'm involved with a lot of organizations and movements in the US that are doing exactly that. And they are becoming stronger. There's more momentum around them. They're growing in size. And so at the end of the day, you know, that will have its turn sooner or later. That will emerge and steer things in a better direction. So yeah, I think we've been through things like this before, but you know, but it's a defining moment in a way. And so how can we help turn things in the right direction and move towards more peaceful societies versus like letting the decay take over our lives? We have to be peace builders in our own lives and communities. We need a critical mass of Americans to speak up against violence, to say this isn't okay, to get out in their communities, to find people with different views and start those conversations. We need Americans to decide, I'm at my limit. I'm not going to accept the destruction anymore. I myself am going to get involved in building something better. And when enough Americans do that, then, you know, that's when that will take off and we'll build something better. So it's every American has a choice to make. We all have a choice to make. And it's a good time to make that choice. If anybody's on the fence, I actually give away a free report on my website called 6 Ways to Be a Peace Builder. So if there are people out there who just don't know what to do, they want to do something, they know they need to do something, but they're not sure where to start, you can go to my website, which is peacebuildersunite.com. Get this free report, and it gives you some ideas and some exercises. It also provides reference to some of the big organizations in the U.S. that are doing this peace-building work, that are doing this bridge-building work, and trying to promote a culture of peace and nonviolence.
Well, those softball of softball questions to lob at you. You know, we talk about, you know, bringing down the temperature and trying to build peace and making sure that people, you know, say that political violence is not cool. That work and those things in communities, they can be done hand in hand with both sides of the aisle, right? Both sides should probably want that same thing, don't you think?
Absolutely. Thank you for saying that. My work, I try very hard to be nonpartisan. I'm on the side of peace. I am on the side of unity and diversity, of nonviolence. And I absolutely do not think you have to be in one political party or another to be a human being who wants to build community. I think we all on some deeply, it's a deep human need we have, is to be in community. And we certainly need each other as neighbors to get by. So yeah, I don't think it's about being Republican or Democrat. I think anybody who just wants to help the country do better can jump in and get involved in the ways that we've talked about.
I think that's awesome. So I want you just to shout out all the ways that people can connect more with your cause. You can shout out that book, anything else you got going on. Here's the opportunity.
Okay. Well, again, my website is peacebuildersunite.com. So if you sign up there, you can get the free report and you can stay involved in our community. I've got a Facebook group called Vote for Love, Preventing Violence and Building Peace in the U.S. So that's a place where peace-loving people can come together across divides in the virtual space. I know people think that social media has become too toxic and too polarized, but we're trying to create a space in the midst of all that where we can respect each other and come together across divides. The book is called Overcoming Information Chaos, A Guide to Cultivating Peaceful Communities in the Digital Age. The pre-sale pages are up there. They need some editing, but if people want to go ahead and pre-order the book, they can go to the Barnes & Noble website or bookstore.org. Those are two places where you can pre-order the book, which is coming out this summer. And I also sell stickers and t-shirts, so that you can be proud about being a peace builder and show it on your computer or wear your t-shirt in your community as you wish.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a lot of promotion. I've just given a
Well,
lot.
all of that will be in the show notes. I know. I really, really appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jackson. This has been lovely.
So that was Danielle Reef. Really, really appreciate her joining me. I mean, I learned so much, and honestly, it makes kind of the things that you're seeing about, USAID being slash and cut even more kind of, I guess, sad and scary, just because, as you heard, again, you have to make your own determinations. Maybe you're somebody who says, hey, I don't we don't need to help anybody else. We need to just worry about ourselves. I can respect that to a degree. But I do think at least we can probably agree that, hey, whether we think we should be helping others or not, the work that they're doing is generally good work. It's not just a bunch of crazy nonsense. She talked about a theory where you pick the craziest thing and then just act like everything is that, and certainly not. The work they were doing was good. Whether people think we should be doing it or not, that's up to you to decide for sure. I can't thank Danielle enough for going into her career. Can't thank her enough for talking more about just finding common ground, the work that she's doing now as a peace builder. Really, really important work. She's somebody who has done a lot of really amazing things throughout her life, literally helping shape the peace in some countries. So really, really awesome to have her on. All the links to her information will be in the show notes. If this is your first time listening or you haven't already, go follow along on Instagram, on TikTok, Not Enough Podcast. Go leave a 5-star rating on Apple and on Spotify. Leave a written review on Apple. Helps even more. Yeah, thanks so much for being here. Take it away, Chris.
This has been Not in a Huff with Jackson Huff. Thank you for listening. Be sure to join us next time, where we will interview another amazing guest who is sure to make you laugh or make you think. Or, hey, maybe even both. But until then, keep being awesome.